Okay, today is November. Today is September 19th, 2016, in Yerushalayim. And I say hello to the Talmidim in front of me and to those listening across the world. We're finishing up the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We still have a little bit of a ways to go. And I received a few inquiries at the last week's shiur. People are curious exactly what it was like in the Beth Israel hospital where the Rebbe gave back his neshama to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So, as I mentioned, I believe I'm the only one in the state of Israel that can make the statement that he actually saw the Rebbe on his final bed. And there's not much I can tell you. We went up the steps. It was the top floor. At the top of the steps, there was a barricade. If I recall correctly, there were two policemen there. No one was allowed up. Of course, Dr. Kabakan was waved on, and I was with him. He was one of the head doctors of Beth Israel. And on the right side was a room where the Rebbe lay, and he was all hooked up to instruments. They were feeding him and giving him liquid. Could very well be antibiotics. Yes, I saw the Rebbe, but all I saw was Lo Aleinu, a very old man with a white beard, covered by a blanket. His beard was over the blanket, and we just, peeked in on him. There was nothing to see, nothing to say, nothing. You couldn't communicate, obviously. On the other side of the hallway was a side room where there was Sidurim, and at the time we were there, Rabbi Leibel Groner, one of the three top of the secretariat that surrounded the Rebbe. Leibel was, one of them was his driver, Rabbi Klein, and Rabbi Krinsky, should live and be well, was more the administrator. And the Rabbi Leibel Groner, was more the Rebbe's right hand. If he needed a safe and needed a source, he was like with the Rebbe at every spur of the moment. And I gathered that at all times there was someone there from the secretariat. In other words, if a decision had to be made, there was someone there at all times, 7 to 24. And the Leibel was sitting on the side, and he Dafka was eating supper at the time. And we spoke with him. What we spoke about, as I recall, was the Rebbe's condition, which we all knew was hopeless, in at least bidei bas of Adam. And we spoke about the future, what will be. It's not that he could give us any great guidance or any great answers, but he too was caught up, liacha meyav yesru shana, what will be. So that's essentially what I can say. Nothing earth-shaking that I can add to what I said last week. But one thing is certain, that they kept them alive purposely to avoid what they were worried about, mass suicides, mass depression. There is something to be said that when a person dies suddenly, it's very shocking. It's good for the person who died, but it's bad for those around him. Lo aleinu, when a person suffers, it's bad for that person, but at least the people around him make peace with the reality. So we're all human beings, we're all caught up in this, and there's no easy way to depart from the world. Either way, it leaves difficult situations. But the Rebbe did die, and because the Rebbe died, and it gave, there were months where it was obvious he was dying, it enabled the people to make their peace, to make their adjustment. Now, we spoke last week what the Rebbe left very uniquely, and no one else in the generation comes to this, the concept of shluchim, the concept of kiruv, the concept of one more mitzvah. And I want to focus on the shluchim today and raise certain issues, certain problems. You'll see it's great achievement, but it's achievement that we have to watch 50 years, 100 years from now, how it will play out. But I want to say something very important now, very sharp and very, I consider it very insightful, and it goes back to what I said yesterday in class as well. You can have the greatest product in the world, but there has to be a need for the product. In other words, it could be Einstein could come up with an invention that, oh, is fabulous, but if only 10 people in the world need the invention or understand the invention, it's not going to sell very well. In honor of Charlie Hexter, I'll say if Ben and Jerry's came up with the Harosis ice cream, if you recall, they thought it would be a gimmick and they didn't make enough. Everyone, Harosis ice cream, people went crazy. Pesach, Harosis ice cream, you know, the best of two worlds, ice cream and Harosis. So there was a market for it. What's happened in the Orthodox world is we are so acclimated to living in two worlds, the big world beyond, that we want the best out of both worlds. If you ask a parent, your children, I want my children to be Talmid Chacham, I want them to have secular degrees, I want them to earn a living. And our whole life standard of living is infinitely on a higher level than it was 100 years ago. For instance, you go to people in Teaneck, New Jersey, in Englewood, in Boston, in Los Angeles, in New York, who hasn't traveled? Everyone travels today. Whoever dreamt Jews could travel so easily? Traveling, Shabbat, Kashrut, yet, Mikvot, we travel. Israeli kids after the army, the Tiyul. My grandson recently went to Georgia, to Grisia, and I said, what was this Tiyul about? He said, this was my post-army Tiyul. He's married now, but his wife was doing a special course. She didn't need him at home. So he went to Grisia. He's traveling, enjoying life. How many thousands upon thousands of Israelis are traveling and enjoying life? Do you see what I'm leading at? Chabad has a product that the Torah world is very anxious to take. Chabad's product, they are able, willing to give you Yiddishkeit no matter where you travel, no matter where you are. You can be in the most farvuffener plots in the Welt, Kalamazoo, Michigan. You can fall off the map. There will be a Chabadnik to catch you. And you see, this adds, it's not that you just have shluchim. You have shluchim that are very valued, very needed, very appreciated. And I know from my own family, my son-in-law is very involved in defense of this country. He does a lot of traveling. At times he's been to places that I don't recall too many other Orthodox Jews winding up in South Korea. And the first thing he does when he gets an assignment, he contacts the Chabad Shaluach. And right away, he knows where he can stay for Shabbat. He knows about kosher food. It is fabulous. That's one part of Chabad the Shluchim. There is an absolute need for them today. There's another part. Put it up, let it blow a little. It's on, but it's not cool back there?
It needs to go down in temperature.
Okay, so put it down to 20. Okay. Oh, so you made it, okay. If it's not good, we'll put it down. Now it's 22, but it's blowing hard. So you see, Chabad has a built-in personnel across the world that is looking for the work that only they can do. But that's only part of it. We today are very spoiled. What do I mean we're very spoiled? When we grew up as kids, if we had something kosher, we were very happy. I remember pretzels in World War II, after World War II, seeing the Goyish kids eat pretzels. I thought that pretzels were like God's greatest gift to humanity, and we couldn't eat them. It was made with lard, with shortening. Today, oh, we're not satisfied just with pretzels. We have to have every type of food available, kosher, of course. But you go into Pomegranate, who would ever dream that they would come, you'd have a store like Pomegranate, and Jews will spend a fortune to get every type of kosher food on the highest level you can imagine. Who would dream all the Parava ice cream that we have today? I remember when they were experimenting in the 70s with Tofutti, I think it was called Tofutti, a guy named Mintz. He was the one that finally got the breakthrough on the first Parava ice cream. He had a delicatessen, and in back of the store, he experimented for years. And then he made it very big. I believe he got divorced. I mean, it's unbelievable. When you make it big and suddenly you have money, there are always endless problems that go with it. No, in order to have every treat in the world and every food in the world, there are more than 50 plants in communist China that are under supervision today. Where will you find mashgichim? And here too, the Chabad Shuluchim play an amazing role in making available to the world all the kosher food. And right here in this article, in this chapter, in the book I quoted to you by Friedman and Heilman, is exactly what I told you. He tells the exact story. I don't know, maybe he heard me tell the story. I thought I knew a big secret, that there was a fight in this very building about declaring Chabad Chutz L'Tchum. Why are you Rosh Yeshiva? Colleagues of mine. They were furious because they announced in YU in Manhattan that there's going to be a weekend for YU people in Chabad. So over 100 students signed up. Over 100, that's quite a number. So the Rosh Yeshiva got all upset. I don't want to mention names, but it's among them Rabbein that you studied with. And they wanted to declare Chabad Chutz L'Tchum, and there was a big machloket, and I argued with them here. I'm not going to repeat the whole machloket, but it was right in front of the students. And then when they got back to America, the argument ended, and they didn't declare Chabad Chutz L'Tchum. So students said to me here, Rebbe, look, you won that. I said, I won nothing. I got the inside story. When they got back, Rabbi Ganak, the Tsar of Kashrut, told them, if you declare Chabad Chutz L'Tchum, we got to close down the OU. That exact story basically is right here on page 280. So you see, right away, Chabad not only has a product, but it has a product that people need, people want. We are so acclimated to the big world beyond, we don't want to make compromises today. We can get kosher food anywhere. We can get deluxe kosher food. We can travel anywhere. We can go anywhere. And we know that the Chabad Shaluach is waiting to help us. Okay? This is part of the story. But there's another part of the story. The whole question of university, and this is a very, very delicate question. Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, gave YU its backbone, gave YU its spiritual guidance. He became a lodestar at YU. Everyone talks about YU until today. They talk about Rav Soloveitchik. I was just, someone gave me a link, a Talmud sent me a link, Aryeh Liebman, to a talk that the dean of Touro, one of the deans of Touro, gave on the Rav, Professor Abramson, Henry Abramson. All right, I listened. I was just curious to see how people who are not Talmidim of the Rav understand the Rav. The lecture was nishkasha, not bad at all. Some small mistakes that had he read my book thoroughly, he might have had a better grasp of the details of the Rav's life, but that's unimportant. But let's talk about the Rav for 1 second. He was Mr. YU. He gave the Hechsher to YU. Everyone in YU looked up to him. Yitzchak, where did his son, our classmate, go to college? Tell the class, Harvard. That's correct. Where did his daughters go to college? Radcliffe, all right or wrong? So many Torah Jews that whom I know, they say, look, my son, I don't want him to be a rabbi. He's not interested in being a rabbi. Let him get the best secular education he can. And there's so many from Jews on so many fine, good college campuses. And you know that in back of the parents' minds, one of the attributes that makes them comfortable in sending their children away today is that there's a Chabad on every major campus. So the kid can go. They're not the only ones there. I'm not trying to undermine the OU and what the OU is doing. Kol HaKavod. Hillel houses at times. Kol HaKavod. But everyone knows Chabad is available. Their minyanim, their lectures, their Shabbos, their singing, there's a fabrengen. It becomes something that the parents feel confident. I can send my kid to Harvard, I can send my kid to Yale, I can send my kid to the UFP, I can send my kid to Wesley, I can send my kid to Radcliffe, I can send my kid to UCLA. And there is an orthodox framework that he can seek out and feel at home and daven and learn and be able to do many mitzvot. And I have to tell you,
I wish they didn't think that.
You're a graduate of UFP, no?
I know, but almost all of the Frum kids that I knew there became less Frum in the time they were there.
Okay,
the only ones who were the exception to that were the Bali Shuvah.
Bali Shuvah. So you should know that is a real problem on the American scene. And I've said more than once that why you would be better off if there wasn't Chabad on campus, if there wasn't the OU on campus. You understand what I'm saying? Because then the parents would think twice about sending the kid elsewhere. But that's the reality. You can't change the reality. And Chabad does a job. What you just said is very true. It's a challenge to us, to Malamdin, to my students who are Malamdin. Why do we fail with so many good kids from such fine from homes? I can understand the kid gets a Haredi education and then the kid runs away, and I've been involved with this more than once. I can understand it very well. But my kid is rebelling. I've gotten calls, my parents destroyed me. The kid sent to Cheder by his parents. His father has a PhD. And the kid is sent to Cheder. My parents destroyed me. I have no way to earn a living. I have no way to do bagrut. And these kids totally rebel, and books are written, particularly when the women run away. They're more capable than men, and they write books. You all know what's been written in America, unorthodox, etc. One book after another. One woman committed suicide in America. A woman committed suicide here. It's a sad story. But I'm talking about kids raised in fine, what you call in popular language, modern Orthodox homes. Kids who were given the best of Torah, the best of general education. And these kids go away to college, and there too, we lose in the state of Israel. What you just said may apply to the army as well. Many kids go in from, and they become Dachlashim, Dachayim Lisha Ava. And many kids go in nothing and become Balei Tshuva stronger than ever. And this is a challenge in Chinuch. Yes, Rabbi Rubin.
For many years, the neighborhood had two organizations they could be proud of. But the laymen didn't have any Jewish foresight. They had the neighborhood ADL, which of course
right.
You know, and they had the Hillel Foundation.
Right.
Which Norman Fuller and
right. Well, we spoke about yesterday.
Right. Now, they stopped it. It used to be that there were rabbis, whether they're conservative, Orthodox, or Reformed, but there were rabbis and Hillel houses and campuses all over the United States.
Right.
Then the B'nai B'rit, the layman, it's a layman organization, decided that this is a waste of money, and the people are not going to give money for Hillel, they'll give money for ADL. So they dropped the whole program.
Okay.
So here there's a Hillel now on the campus. It's only because the local Jewish community
supports it.
Right.
But you see, Chabad is all over. Chabadnik goes, he gets support for the first 2 years, from Crown Heights. Afterwards, he's on his own. And then you have people like George Rohr, who put millions and millions of dollars.
But how successful can a Chabadnik be? And maybe never went to college himself. And the fellows who are in school, take you a peek. We're our friend here.
So take a look.
That's exactly the model of Kirov that the Rebbe rejected, and he proved that his model was right.
What's that?
Which is that it's not true that you need those kinds of extrinsic things to makarv people. The person who's going to be the most successful Zohar has a tremendous spiritual dedication,
the heart,
and a real commitment to helping Jewish people.
Right. Because they're not looking to the shluach for a course in Einstein. They're looking to the shluach to warm up their hearts. It's like, you remember I told you last week, my student David Goldis, the accountant, and I told you the story of this person who does the accountancy for, and he ran away from Las Vegas to L.A. You won't believe it. This past Shabbat was his third Shabbat total observance, and he decided to come back home to Israel. And he's going to Netivot. He comes from down south. And he's going to run the business from here for the time being. So you see, he didn't need anyone to give him a course, in a graduate school course in Sai Sims. What he needed was someone to turn on his heart. So I think you have to take Alex's answer very, very seriously. So you see, the shluchim, it's not just that Chabad came up, that the Rebbe came up with an idea. The Rebbe came up with an idea that fits like a glove on a hand in the current Torah world. And I can't say it any better. I tell you, we were in Cairns in Australia. So when Australia contacted me to visit there, so I went for a month, Malka and I went, 2 weeks in Melbourne, 2 weeks in Sydney. So right away they asked, what can we pay you? I say, look, what am I going to do with Australian money? I said, thank God I make a living. I said, arrange some touring that I could never do on my own. So they get back to me, when you're in Sydney, we're going to take off, because there it's not the same community as Melbourne, you'll be in Sydney, we're going to take off 5 days, and you can either go to New Zealand or to Cairns. Cairns is the kickoff place for the Great Barrier Reef. It's the seaport, and you're facing Japan. So I think I told the story. If I did, you can stop me. We choose Cairns. We go to Cairns. We think we're in the other end of the world. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Whoever saw a Jew here? It's where are we? We're falling off the map. Look where Cairns is. First of all, kosher food is no problem whatsoever. You're going to the supermarket around the corner from the hotel, kosher food from France, from Melbourne, Hashkaches, OU. So that problem disappears. But we get a note from the owner of the hotel, comes to our room. Dear Rabbi and Mrs. Rakefet, it is my great honor to host one of the greatest Jewish scholars of the world today. I would like to meet you in my office. And with the note comes a tremendous tray filled with fruit. I still have the tray. We use it until today. Filled with all types of fruits. Anyway, we call the secretary, make an appointment. Go down to the office. How do you know who we are? He says, Chabad got in touch with us from Sydney. And he starts telling us how Chabad takes over a part of the hotel on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, kashes the kitchen, brings Jews there. And as he starts talking about Yiddishkeit, and this man, his name was Mr. Smith Sr., his son was Mr. Smith Jr., as he starts talking about Yiddishkeit, his eyes, tears start coming down. And he pulls out a picture and he says, this is what I looked like when I ran away from Hitler to Australia. A Yiddish kind in Galicia with pears. Totally assimilated. Fought in World War II, the Australian Navy. A Yiddish cup, saw that this was a place for tourism, bought the hotel, built it up, conquered the world, totally forgot he's Jewish. Chabad picked him up. Can you believe it? And I don't know, there may be a Chabadnik living in Cairns today. I don't know if there are any Jews living there, but in the hotel, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, that's Chabad. You see? And we benefit. You come to the hotel, could you imagine? Then we met Rabbi Apple in the hotel. Do you know Rabbi Raymond Apple? He was vacationing there. A rabbi comes to the hotel, this guy dances a kazatska with joy. Visited Israel, gives heavy money to Israel. Unbelievable. When I first looked at him, looked at his son, and I saw all these beautiful Australian women, the son is not married. Yes, Mr. Smith Jr., yes, Mr. and bowing and humbling. I figured these are goyim gemurim. This is Chabad, and there's a need for it. It's a product with a need. And we, modern Orthodox Jews, we're guilty. We don't want to compromise. We want the best of both worlds. I got to give the Eidei Haredit credit, although I think they're off the wall. They won't give a hechsher on Pesach to any food that their parents didn't eat. The only exception they made were potato chips. Yeah? We, just the opposite. The more food for Pesach, you go and talk and forget about legumes. No legumes. Baby food of every type. Morning cereals of every type. It's been cakes of every type, rolls of every type. Rebbeinu Shel Olam, we don't know it's Pesach anymore. I grew up in Pesach, you had beets, you had borscht, you had hard-boiled eggs, you had meat, I remember the breakstones, they went, Rabbi Goldstein, they kashered, today it's unbelievable. Chabad is there, we need them, they have a product that is highly saleable. What did I say 15 minutes ago? Ben and Jerry's Haroset ice cream. Now, there's another point about Shluchim too. And here it resembles YU. And this is part of the rabbinate, part of being Shluchim. It's good, and it can be not so good. And what do I mean? When you leave the heartland, when you were at the 770, and every day you saw the Rebbe, every day you saw the people who surrounded the Rebbe, the Dayanim, the Poskim, the Rosh Yeshiva in Chabad, you saw Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael. Yeah? You remain a humble person. You go to YU, room 102, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, Mori Rebbe is teaching. Room 103, Reb David Lifshitz. Room 101, Reb Moshe Aaron Palev is teaching. No, you remain a humble person. Then you're out in the big world. And you can have Rabbanim, you can have Shluchim, who become world famous people unto themselves. This is part of life. Tremendous achievers. They build up a reputation second to none. And I'll give you some examples. The greatest example we have today is Rabbi Beryl Lazar of the Soviet Union. Rabbi Lazar, just think for a minute, his parents, if I'm not mistaken, were among the first shluchim the Rebbe sent out, sent them to Italy. And he was raised in a home where Yiddish was spoken, English was spoken. He winds up a shaluch to Russia, post-communist Russia. And here's an individual who went, if you look at Rabbi Lazar, he's not a very tall, broad person. He's not a football player or a basketball star. He's average height, average build. Hard to believe what this one man accomplished. Today in the Soviet Union, you all know that Putin himself is a devotee of Chabad. Beryl Lazar, what he has built, what he has accomplished, even with the manuscripts, you don't start to appreciate, you know, we Jews can be very critical. We don't know how to be generous. These manuscripts, which were robbed, no two ways about it. The communist world, I've lectured on this, their questions, they naturalized factories, they robbed from people. You go, how many of you have you been, what's the Hermitage? The big, beautiful museum, maybe the biggest museum in the world, what the Hermitage owns, how many rows of pictures, pictures on top of pictures, on top of pictures. Now, who was there? Who was there? Yitz, you were there. I was there. Anybody else there? Are you allowed to look at those pictures? They were owned, robbed. No one gave them those pictures willingly. Communist Empire took over, they own everything. You know the history of communist Russia, the nationalization of the farms, the starvation in the Ukraine. No? They took all the manuscripts of Chabad, became part of the Lenin Library. And what went on, they went into court in New York and they wanted back and it was robbed. And what? How do they keep it? And communism is over, and be honest, no, the Russians view, these are Jewish Russians, these are Russian citizens, this belongs to Russia. Well, you saw what Putin did. He did something ingenious, established a branch of the Lenin Library that he gave over to Chabad, and all the manuscripts are in this branch. Kol hakavod to Rabbi Lazar. And everyone in the world, everything is being made available. Everything will be available to any scholar, any Chabadnik, any Hebrew Jew person, any scientific scholar. You can see these manuscripts and research them. And this is a fabulous achievement. Who does it belong to? The Russian government, the Lenin Library. Who runs it? Chabadnikim. It's a separate branch. It's closed on Shabbos. It's a tourist attraction. I mean, Putin and Rabbi Lazar are geniuses. They put it together. And this Rabbi Beryl Lazar, the education, of course.
What city is this in?
In Moscow. Lenin Library. It's a branch of the Lenin Library. But Rabbi Beryl Lazar, got to give all the credit in the world. And he's one example. You go to Washington, D.C., there's the Shem Tov family, Avremel Shem Tov. I first met part of the Shem Tov family in the early 50s when the Rebbe started creating waves. We heard about what's going on in Crown Heights, so we wanted a Tanya Shir at YU. We had a Tanya, you remember Yitz? Were you there? Thursday night, oh no, I was in high school, it was before you came from Boston. And it was Thursday night. And it was a Rabbi Shem Tov. All I know is, I don't remember his first name, it could be this is the Shem Tov. And Rabbi Tendler got hysterical, and they stopped the shir. Chas v'chalila, Chabad should be teaching in YU. That was 60 years ago. Today, Baruch Hashem, we have Chabadnikim, real Chabadnikim students in YU, let alone Fabrengans, let alone going to 770. But the Shem Tov, you go to Washington, they say nobody knows the politicians. No one can get you quicker to a congressman, to a senator, to Rabbi Shem Tov. And he's beloved by everybody. Takes no political stand. He's not going to... That's the family. Exactly. That is the family. If I'm not wrong, the one in Washington was originally in Philadelphia. He's from that family. I remember when I was in Philly. That was the Shem Tov family. But he's not going to take a stand. Clinton, Trump, he will be only interested in Yiddishkeit, the message, the Hanukkah candles, the latkes, leave a good taste. Then you come to Los Angeles, and here I mentioned someone that I'm close to. His first cousin is one of my closest friends, Barry Liebman, Refuah Shleima. I told Morty before class, it's very hard for me. My two of my best friends are not well, and I have to make peace with my age. I'm announcing that I recognize my age. I got a good slap in the face Thursday night. I had to go to the Kotel. Baruch Hashem, I had a hashpah of my final grandson. I now have 13 out of 13 in the Israeli Defense Forces. So in the old days, till I was 75, I flew back and forth from my house to the Kotel. It was nothing. Here I parked on King David Street, and I walked to the Kotel, sat the whole time, walked back to King David Street. I woke up Friday morning, don't ask how sick I've been in, and I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu that medicine works, and that Vic gave me some very special vitamin C pills last night, which enable me to look at you and laugh and teach and cry and be a Jew again. But I recognize my age. Wow. So Rabbi Kunin is Barry Liebman's first cousin. Shlomo Kunin, L.A., do you know what L.A. was in my time? People who moved to L.A., we used to have an expression, they walk naked in L.A. I don't know if they walked naked, but they were off the wall. Who lived on the coast? That was where was the big concert in 69 that changed the whole world? What was it called? Woodstock. L.A. was one big Woodstock to the second power. I remember when Malka's aunt moved there, so Malka's mother, Malka comes, you know, her family's been in America 150 years. So Malka's mother, family of four, and the sister was Shoyma Shomeret Shabbat. But when she moved to L.A., Malka's mother said, "Oh, that's the end. And the parents remained Shomeret Shabbat, but the kids didn't know an aleph from a bet. Lo aleinu, L.A. at that time. Shlomo Kunin went there. The Rebbe sent him 50 plus years ago. What that man built in L.A., what that man accomplished, and not only that, the outreach, how he caught up with the Hollywood mentality. He not only helps Jews, he helps non-Jews. He has a center, detoxification, to help kids on drugs, kids on liquor, the problems we have today. And he has the TV marathon where he raises millions and millions and millions of dollars. And this is ingenious, what he's been able to accomplish. And you'll say, well, he's helping Gentiles too. That's wonderful. We're obligated to help Gentiles. First, you have to help Jews. You have to help Gentiles as well. I don't have to tell you, in Open Gemara, you bury the Gentiles, you do chesed to them just like the Jews. You give tzedakah just like the Jews. We have to keep good relationships. But there's a genius here, because you can go with a universal program, a universal request, you get a lot more money. And from that money, you not only help the Gentiles, but you certainly help the Jews as well. And I can tell you, that's exactly what Bernie Lander told me. You have to understand my relationship with Bernie Lander. Bernie Lander, I'm being very brief now, but you all know that Aaron Rakefet became Aaron Rakefet because of Bernie Lander. I wrote my doctorate. He was the one that pushed me to write on Rabbi Dov Revel. So we had a very unique relationship. Now, Bernie Lander always felt a little guilty in my presence that he is running university, Toro, and all these schools. They're non-denominational. They're not just Jewish. Graduate schools, Toro, what is Toro? It was just a college. There's very little Torah learning. But Bernie Lander used to say to me, yes, I make my money from the non-Jews, but Torah benefits. Land the college, what's the yeshiva called? Eitz Chaim, what's the name? Torat Chaim, is anyone know? The one in Kew Gardens Hills. Or Chaim. That's all funded by money that's being brought in by all the branches of Toro. So you see, on one hand, Toro becomes a great, a center for goodness for the entire world. And on the other hand, the money flows in to Torah institutions. And that's exactly, when you look at some of the shluchim, you look at Rabbi Shlomo Kunin in Chabad, so you can laugh at him from today to tomorrow. The man runs all these marathons, he's on TV, he's friendly with all these movie actors, Shem Tov, politicians, but when all is said and done, Beru Lazar, look how Yiddishkeit benefits. So you see that the shluchim, it's not just there's a need for them, but it opens up areas where they can become very unique, very special, very individualistic. They can become, when you speak in terms of Rabbi Beryl Lazar, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, people will be doing doctorates in political science, how a little Jewish kid, American, Italy, his origins, had such an impact on someone like Putin. It's a fascinating thought. Okay, but more than that, and here you got to give Chabad credit, and this is exactly like YU. When we go out into the world and we want to hit a home run, we have to come up with an idea. We have to shake people up. The average person in the world, and then this is the way dictatorships could function. If you ever went to communist Russia, you would always ask the question, how stupid can these people be? If you remember in Russia, for instance, in the winter, all they had available were apples. Apples, every store. Jelly, there was one type of jelly, no choice whatsoever, apple jelly. The summer maybe was a different type. If they got oranges from Morocco, people would wait online. I couldn't believe it, the pictures I took. They would stop work, no one worked in the community. 2 hours they would wait online to buy 1 kilo of oranges. It was rationed. How do you tolerate that? But you see, the average person, and if he has food, clothes, and a place to sleep, and in Russia, for instance, Moscow, there was heat, as cold as it was, they had central heating stations, that there was heat all over Moscow, a big sprawling city. People are happy, people are satisfied. How do you wake people up? You have to do something, you have to shake them up. Can I take you to Harlem? Let's go back 105 years. Sunday morning, a young graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary, Herbert S. Goldstein, would lead a parade of the kids in the street marching to Hebrew school on Sunday morning. He woke the people up. Can I take you to the Upper West Side, the late 60s? It's Rabbi Stephen Riskin built a shul in the round. No other shul like that we have even heard about. And you come in and you're sitting and everyone can see everyone else. At that point, the mechitza was quite low. Today already it's a more traditional shul. Something different. Young rabbi speaks the language, meeting the challenge. Ah, a shame dava. Stevie Wonder, as he was called. Chabad came up with gimmicks that are second to none. Hanukkah candle lightings. New? You've seen the video clippage out of Moscow where they're using ladders and hoisting you, and there is Putin standing next to Beryl Lazar, and in the Kremlin they're lighting Hanukkah candles. New? A Litvak can be cynical. Believe me, I showed you the picture of Yeruchim Yerelik yesterday. A Litvak would be cynical from today to tomorrow. But when you light Hanukkah candles in the public thoroughfare, you wake up Jews. Hey, wait a minute. I shouldn't be ashamed of my Judaism. I shouldn't hide my Judaism. I should be proud. What's wrong with going in the public thoroughfare? Here, he describes here in Siberia, there was a shul that hadn't been used for 60, 70 years since the communists took over. In the 1990s, Chabad went in, and that Rosh Hashanah, they didn't just blow shofar in the shul. They blow shofar outside the shul. And everyone walking by, whispering, talking, come to the synagogue, something special. Some were Jokayim, and some had Jewish blood. The shofar wakes you up. The mezuzah campaigns. In the heart of London, the fanciest area, in Bloomsbury, suddenly Chabad took over the university dormitories there. Anyone who's Jewish and wants a mezuzah, we are making mezuzahs available free of charge. So you see, there is something to Chabad. the individualism, the ability to reach out, the ability to be different, that shluchim can become tremendous personalities in their own right. All right. But now there's a downside. And this is a serious problem. And I remember living this problem. If you go to the volume, it begins on page 286. I'll put it into our terms. This plays out against a football game. It really happened. Super Bowl. But since I'm not a great football fan, then I can tell you why I'm not a great football fan. I'm not a great football fan because I took Musa seriously. And my greatest teacher outside of Rav Soloveitchik, Mori Urebi, was the Mashkiach of the Yeshiva, Rav Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson. And I took every word he said seriously. And Rav Lesson, was a bit Americanized. He had lived in America for many years. And he said in the Shmuas that he gave, baseball, I can understand that you kids are all attracted to baseball. But football, min da haget ene de andere, they kick one around, the other one. How can you be interested in football? From that point on, I remained a baseball devotee. I'm being honest, not football.
I thought you were going to say because football is more violent.
That's what I just said. Mindahaget. Oh, you don't know Yiddish, Alex. How do you understand the Rebbe? You listen to the Rebbe. You're way behind.
I'm willing.
No. It's not. We're going to get to that. It's not the same. Not the same. You got to have earphones. Baruch Hashem, I'm still from the generation that rapidly is disappearing.
What is that?
We don't need earphones.
They just put out a 5-volume book that translates the Rebbe on Chumash and his views on Rashi in English, Keot.
Keot, who put it out? Miller?
Keot.
No, but who's the author? Rabbi?
I don't know who the author is. The previous author was Sachs, and he put out a book called Studies in Chumash.
Studies.
And Rebbe of the Rebbe on Chumash, which is very fascinating.
So you, and I'm
it's being translated.
Fine. You fellas can live in English. When I want to hear the Rebbe, I want to hear him in Yiddish.
I'm hoping to take Yiddish in the future.
No, but say that.
No, I'm being serious.
We'll talk in English. It's okay now. But that's exactly what Rav Lesson said. Min da haget. You know what that means? Da haget? You kill. One is killing. You're pushing, shoving, beating. So I'll tell it in put it into my context. The Yankees are playing the Red Sox. All right, this is the 1950s. The Yankees are the favorites. The Red Sox are the underdogs. No, a Chabad Shaluach will get hold of a Red Sox fan. And this happened. The name of the fan is Jay Greenfield. And he said, the Shaluach said to him, you want the Red Sox to win? Put on tefillin. This guy put on tefillin. The Red Sox won. Now there's another game. And this really happened. It's a true story. Not with the Red Sox and the Yankees, but with the New York Giants. And the other team was the New England Patriots, if I have it right. And a whole group of fellas are putting on tefillin. And the Chabad Shaluach tells them, I'm going to the Rebbe's grave, Springfield Avenue, and I'm putting in a kvittel that the Giants should win, even though they were underdogs. And the Giants won, and they continued to
give me one second.
And they continued, they promised the Chabad Shaluach they would continue to put on tefillin. So of course, I don't have to tell you, this is, how do you accept it? What do you say? That this is what Torah's about? Whether the Giants win, whether the Patriots win, whether the Red Sox win, whether the Yankees win, tefillin, are you going to make your tefillin dependent? See, this becomes, You're getting involved in mass selling and sugarcoating and a lollipop in a sugar daddy, call it what you wish. Is this really religion? So you should know that this became a source of tremendous controversy, this story with Jay Greenfield. I don't know what Jay Greenfield is today, but the Chabad Shaluch said, look, it's a start. I wanted them to experience tefillin. I wanted them to taste tefillin. I recognize it's only a start. So you see, there's a delicate balance here. How far can you go to sugarcoat Judaism? And this delicate balance comes up time and again, not only with Chabad, but right down the line when we're involved in outreach. How far can you compromise? How far can you popularize? Where is the line of demarcation? Where can we say and where do we say, gentlemen, ladies, life is not a Broadway show. Continuity of the Jewish people is mixed with achievement and frustration, with joy, with tears. When do we tell the truth? And when do we say, put the tefillin on so that the Yankees, the Red Sox will win? It's a very difficult line. You can't give a black and white answer. I don't want Yiddishkeit to be that, if I'm a good boy and observe Shabbos, the Patriots will win. Is that Yiddishkeit? On the other hand, maybe the Chabad Shluch is right. I got them to put on tefillin. Maybe tefillin will become an act unto himself and will start to understand what Torah is all about. Delicate question. Yitzchak.
There is a misuse of religion completely, which are described. And it turns out, for example, Solomash once wrote
right.
In an autobiographical study of himself. Why? What turned him to be no longer religious?
Right.
His father told him, don't look at the Birchas Kohanim because right. You get blind.
Right.
So, of course, he was a young boy.
He looked at the corner.
He looked at the Birchas Kohanim and
didn't get blind.
So if you tell someone, put on a mezuzah to protect the house. You don't have to have insurance, and you don't have to have...
And
all of a sudden, the house is pillaged.
Fire. And you know where the fire was yesterday? You heard about Give Up Mordechai?
Yeah.
It's my grandson's home, my grandson's building. Had to evacuate my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren in the middle of the night.
So you see, this is not religion. This is Druidism. This is... using religion as a room.
I'm sure that was just a semi-humorous gimmick,
Alex and Yitzchak. It was a tremendous, it was a very honest debate then, and the Chabad Shluch justified it, said it was just a start. But you all see there is danger here. You have rabbis out in the field, particularly the further you go away from the source of Torah, you become a law unto yourself. And that's exactly the point I want to make. Hold on. There's a danger here. The YU people, you face it as well. You're away from the Rebbeim. The Rebbeim are gone. The Rebbeim are dead. You're a law unto yourself. You saw what I quoted yesterday, Herzl Hefta, Harry Hefta. It's unbelievable how we responded. Yes, my Rebbeim, Rabbi Lu would disagree, Rabbi Soloveitchik would disagree. It doesn't mean a darn thing to him. They can disagree from today to tomorrow. The further a Chabadnik goes out in the world and he's Matzliach, he too can go off the path. In the history of Chabad, there are three shluchim who Chabad had to disown publicly. Two in the Rebbe's lifetime, and one afterwards. In the Rebbe's lifetime, the prime example was Zalman Schachter, later Shlomi. He and Shlomo LeKalbach were sent by the sixth Rebbe already to do outreach on college campuses. And Shlomi, who died, a year or two ago, it's recent. He became a god unto himself, became a religion unto himself. Here you have a Chabadnik, had smicha, was very close to the sixth Rebbe, to the seventh Rebbe, and here he becomes a recipient of a degree from Hebrew Union College, and he practices a new type of religion, a more universal religion, a law unto himself, distant not just from Chabad, distant from Torah Hashem. Shlomo Kalbach, who was his partner, they started together with their guitars. Shlomo Kalbach, the Rebbe, seventh Rebbe, ultimately had to disown him. Now, I want to say, L'schut Shlomo Kalbach, he did not leave the path totally. He was caught up in a vice. He was Shlomo Kalbach. He was reaching out. He was very capable. He was very charismatic. And he felt that if you didn't have men and women coming together, people would not come at all. The Rebbe felt you had to keep the men and the women separate. Shlomo went on to become a kingdom unto himself. He did outward acts that we have a big problem accepting. He lived in a world, I would say, a troubled duality of existence. We'll talk about Shlomo Kalbach in our Sunday class, how he comes into the halachic literature. But he too was disowned by Chabad, but Chas v'Chalila, I don't want to place him on the same level as Shachta Shlomi. The third person is a more modern person, a very controversial person who outwardly has not left Torah one iota, has not left Chabad one iota. It's a person that I know, and I can tell you he's married to a fabulous lady. His name is Shmuley Boteach. He's had a difficult life. His parents got divorced. Chabad picked him up and gave him parental guidance that he didn't have at home. And he became a full Chabadnik. He is a very brilliant individual. And he was rabbi, where was it, at Oxford, if I remember correctly. And he did wonders there, very popular. But he became a world personality. But that didn't turn Chabad off. He became a master of selling Yiddishkeit through sex. And when he published his book, Kosher Sex, Chabad had to disclaim him. That already was too far. Now, I have to tell you, I read the book, and there's nothing in there that's against the halacha.
The man is clever.
But
it's
Yitzhak says the man is clever, not evil. But there's sentences in there that I cannot mouth. I cannot mouth it. It's I cannot. It's not be kedusha be tahara. But Chabad, yes, he's not evil. He's clever. He's smart.
He's missing one thing.
Excuse me.
He's missing one thing.
Yeah.
Humility.
Humility. That's the problem with all the people who succeed like this. Shach the Shlomi, all his humility disappeared. And that's why it's so important that when I see my Rebbe sitting next to me, I am humbled. Exactly. That's what we spoke about yesterday, the Rav. Humility in the encounter with tradition. He's missing your... But these are three shluchim, you see? You go out in the world and you can conquer the world, but you become a personality unto yourself, and this problem becomes more pronounced in modern times because there's no Rebbe, and we'll build on that in a second. Yes, yes, Mori.
I don't know if this is connected, but sort of the same thing. Some of these shluchim go out to these really far out places, and they have to start making personal compromises. There's never minyanim. They'll kriyas a Torah, they'll take a kid and make them the 10th one. because they have nothing there. This has to have an effect on them.
Okay. So what you're saying, and this I spoke about in class a year ago, with the Shaluach, for instance, in Seattle, in beyond Seattle, the capital of Washington, where he doesn't even have a minyan on Yom Kippur. And these are a world of personal compromises. But on the other hand, at least there's nothing there against the halacha. Here you're talking with kosher sex, you're talking with Kalbach, you're talking with Shlomi, you're talking with against the halacha. And it's delicate. I could not be in a place where there's no minyan.
No, I mean,
and yet these people go and build and survive and do.
They're forced into kulos.
Right, I understand. They're forced into a lower level of observance. You know, I think we're doing a misjudgment. I don't know, I
want to say an error maybe. If the minyan is putting Kalbach and Voltaire in the same category with the Zalman Shachter.
No, no, beside that, I...
with Timothy Leary, with
Ross. No, I understand.
He started a whole, his own awakening religion.
Right, he started his own religion. I said that. They're not on the same level.
And
absolutely.
It's all self-discovery. It's a rehash of what I can.
Okay.
But Shlomo Kalbach brought people to Torah.
Right. He remained within, despite his shortcomings.
People were living in the gulag and in the prisons.
Right.
He brought them a feeling that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was there with
Right. And Boteach did miracles in Oxford. He was Makarov, the Senator Corey. And he does...
So the fact that he uses marketing techniques...
Yeah, but... Gentlemen, it's all right.
Gentlemen, how can you talk like that?
Okay, gentlemen, I'm throwing it out for thought. I'm not giving any opinion, but you can understand people out in the field, and I'll give you one more example that he talks about here, and I remember living this. And I'm quoting these examples from the Friedman Heilman book. What I quoted last week, I gave you the sources. And I'll give you one more example. Bond Street, in the heart of London, two young men whose father was a very famous Chabad Shaluach to London, and these are the children, Yossi and Mendy Fogel, organized the Gaon's Club. And this was supposed to be a very high fashion, magnificent club for wealthy people in business and academia to drop in, to be able to have a drink, to smoke, to watch television, internet, everything was there, and there would be a minyan for Mincha, a minyan for Maariv, there would be Shiurim, and Chief Rabbi Jacobowitz, Chief Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Sachs came to the dedication, and I remember on the Israeli TV, and afterwards, mismanagement, overspending, the place went bankrupt. So you see, here too, without any infraction whatsoever, but Chabad was caught up in very bad publicity. So these are the realities. Now there's no Rebbe today. And this is what I alluded to 2 weeks ago when we first began, that what has happened in Chabad, that since the death of the Rebbe, they have taken steps to make it more organized, more controlled, more accessible to 770, to have the people walking the same beat and speaking with the same concepts. And that, of course, is the Shluchim conferences. The Shluchim conferences, it's not just the conference, it's not just the public thoroughfare, it's the classes, it's the literature, it's the interaction, it's the Chevreshaft, it's getting together. The conference of Shluchim is like a Rabbinical Council of America convention multiplied 10 times over. If you speak of a rabbinical council convention of 300 participants, 400 participants, you now have 4,000 plus shluchim. And at least once a year, the shluchim get together, the shluchot get together, and there is a feeling of unity, a feeling of inspiration, a feeling of guidance. This is Chabad. These are the classes they run. These are the programs they run. This is the recognition in Chabad that not every shluach is on the same level to give classes. The Jewish Institute of Learning, everything is spoon-fed to them. The books they use, the computer material they use, the lectures that they give, it's prepared by experts. There is more organization in Chabad than there has ever been before today. Now, can this go on? Can this continue? What will be 50 years, 100 years from now? What Morty said, I'll give it a term, we live a dual life. It's not just Chabadnikim. It's the rabbis out in the field, the compromises, the reality. You're no longer in Borough Park. You're no longer in Yerushalayim. You're no longer in Katamon. You got to remember, in Katamon you have a shtibl. You can get a minion practically 24/7. You live in a Torah center. You go 13th Avenue. You have one shul there where there's a minion all night, all day. It's every 15 minutes without fail. And everyone is out living a dual life. You're trying the karev, and yet the big world is saying hello to you. Can this go on? What will be? And here you come to the little debate we had in class a half hour ago that is so indicative of where Chabad stands. Right now, you have Chabadnikim who still saw the Rebbe, who knew the Rebbe, who knew Yiddish, who heard the Rebbe, who could integrate their own thinking with the Rebbe's thinking. How much longer will this continue? And I want to totally change the subject and tell you one of the most interesting experiences that I ever had that opened my eyes to what Torah is all about. Lahavdil Meya Elif Havdalot. Sunday in the Communist Empire was a very special day. It's the one day everybody had off. Technically, they were supposed to have off on Saturday too, but on Saturday they many times had drives to give an extra day of work for the country, for the government, for the communist idea. And everyone had to do it because there was public pressure on you. If you wanted to keep your job, you had to be a loyal worker. Sunday, and you've seen the pictures of this, everyone would dress up, go to the theater, go to mass meetings, everything was available very cheaply, Communist Empire-controlled costs. They want the public to enjoy, everyone walked around with their medals. So in 1981, we're Sunday, we're in a museum, and, you know, we're taking in the sights, our locals are telling us, watch the medals, you'll see the resplendent communist empire. They didn't get money, but they got medals. They showed them off. There was no humility there. The idea was, this was what you have to boast about. And on the side of the museum, we see an elderly gentleman with endless medals and a whole group of, like, teenagers, 17, 18, 19 years, sitting around and listening in to him with awe. And I asked my people, my high, what's going on here? And you know what they told me? This gentleman had yet heard Lenin speak. He yet knew Lenin. And he is passing on the communist spirit, dedication, devotion, the homeland, Soviet Union, workers of the world unite. And these are kids who really believe. Communist youth. I saw that sight and I said, L'chavdil me'ya elef havdalot, what I would give to sit, the Rav spoke about it. I have it in my work on the Rav. When he met someone who knew someone who yet saw the Vilna Gaon. You with me? L'chavdil. I saw it with my own eyes. And these kids were enthralled. Listening. And the man telling. And this, remember, today, you have a lot of old-timers who knew the Rebbe, heard the Rebbe, were inspired by the Rebbe. What will be 50 years from now, 100 years from now? Can this continue? Fascinating question. Hold on. Why don't you give the Rebbe credit that I, it's my next word. Now, hold on. There's no question, that Chabad is in a better position than Breslov. Breslov, when all is said and done, it's weird. They stop in the middle of traffic, jump out of the car, they start dancing, there's a move on in Jerusalem to outlaw this behavior. All right, they jump up on the car, they park on the side, they're dancing. Tell me, has anyone ever seen a portrait, a picture, an actual picture of the Reb Nachman B. Breslov? Chabad, you have hundreds of hours, it may be thousands of hours of videos of the Rebbe. All right. Black and white videos. Can a kid appreciate it? You have the translations. Millions of dollars have been spent in enhancing these primitive videos, in putting in translations of what the Rebbe is saying. You all know when you come to 770 and you enter on the side, 24-6, you have videos of Fabrenians going around the clock. You go in, I told you, I once, Talmidim took us out to a delicatessen on the Upper West Side, and on both sides of the delicatessen, what's it called? The Kasbah, right. And both sides. You have videos of the Rebbe going.
The airport.
There, another example. The airport. These are very, very serious questions. There's more to the question. What about all the shluchim? Remember, in the Rebbe's lifetime, you began with 2, 3, 10, 100. Maybe when the Rebbe died, you had 1,200 shluchim, if you had that many. 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. You barely have a ballroom big enough for the shluchim conference. Now these shluchim are raising kids. And these kids are being taught the highest ideal in life is to be a shluch. I spoke with them. I saw. I was there. I met this lady who I had been in touch with by telephone. She was in charge of my travel and my topics. I said to her right away, I have a grandson. She looked to me to be like 23, 24. What a beautiful girl, physically, spiritually. I'm a Rebbe, many decades, I can size a person up. I said, come back with me to Jerusalem, I want to introduce you to my grandson. No, she looked at me, and with respect, two different worlds. She has to marry someone from the 770 area wants to be a shluch. My grandson is a Hezda boy, a paratrooper. a different world. No? Now, even if they don't succeed with all the children, I'm very honest. I'm very down to earth. No one succeeds 100%. It's impossible in this world. Maybe be Yomot HaMashiach, Kol Banayach Limudei Hashem. But this is the reality. We don't succeed 100%. We are only Basar Vadam. Okay. What? Rav Soloveitchik succeeded? Mori Rebbe is Talmidim 100%? Rav Aaron Cutler succeeded? Babaji Rebbe, we just spoke about some misfits. Every Rebbe, the Satmar Luv succeeded 100%. What are we talking about? I told you, we were picked up by a Babaji Chassid, a smicha from Kfar Chabad, Bani Shalom. 3.5 hours, he's driving us from the airport to where this convention is taking place. Where was it? What was it called? Palm Springs, California. What a vulgar mouth. What he was involved with. I was praying the police don't pull us over. Maybe there was cocaine in the car and who he's talking with and his business deals. Azar Oiswaf 1,000%. His first life drew him out. His second like this. And he's Eichet a Chabadnik. So you don't succeed with all. But I am willing to put money on the table that Chabad has a higher percentage of success with its children than any other element in the Torah world. I'm willing to bet on it. I've seen Chabad families. I've seen Rabbi Gordon, who I knew from Newark, Reb Shalom Dovber Gordon, his kids. Unbelievable.
Are you talking about the shluchim or just all the community?
No, the shluchim in particular.
Yeah, I agree with that.
No, because the shluchim are the yidit, the yidit, their top quality. Their children, his grandchildren. Rabbi Bogomilsky, my old chaver, Reb Shalom. What a Shmuel Pesach Bogom. What success. Tell me, how are you going to get enough posts? 4,000. 5,000 shluchim. Hey, how many Jews do we have in the world? Where do they wind up? These are real challenges. So, we stand at the crossroads today. We are still part of the generation that have people like Aaron Rakefet who can flip on a DVD and listen to the Rebbe of Fabrengen and understand the Rebbe without earphones. If there's an Aaron Rakefet alive who can do it, certainly in Chabad, the elder of Chabadnikim, the new generation. I told you this story. The 1980s, I had a Talmud here in Gruss, was a Chabadnik. Bought me a ticket. He was a generous student, wanted to honor the Rebbe. Bought me a ticket to the Yutet Kislev from Brengen at Binyanei Huma. I get there like 4 o'clock in the morning. Couldn't believe it. Place is marked. All right, I have a seat. And there's the Rebbe. This is by satellite, I think, at that time already. 10 o'clock, the Fabrengen is beginning in New York, and it's like you're sitting in front of the Rebbe. I couldn't believe it. I've been to many Fabrengens. I never was that close to the Rebbe. You could hear him breathe. You could hear him breathe. And then I looked around. I don't have any earphones. Everyone has earphones. I say to the guy next to me, Maza. Anglit, he's listening to the Rebbe in English. Instant translation. Say to this guy next to me, Mazer, Hebrew. He's listening to the Rebbe in Hebrew. Instant translation. The guy in front of me, Russian. He's listening to the Rebbe in Russian. Instant translation. What will be 50, 70, 100 years from now? Gentlemen, this is a very fair question. None of us can be absolutely certain and give a black and white answer. The leaders of Chabad have to be dealing with these problems and have to think about it. To me, the Shluchim Conference and the organization and all that goes with it is crucial to the future. It's my own gut reaction after seeing Breslov up close, and you don't realize how close I know Breslov. One of my top students' daughter married into a top Breslov family. One of my dearest friends became a Breslover, and his children married into Breslover families. My own feeling is Chabad will not go the way of Breslov. It will not become something very sideshow, I would call it. Chabad has too much vim, vigor, inspiration, dedication, too much learning, too much knowledge, Tanya, and Likutei Torah, and all that goes with it. There's a world of literature. It will remain a very firm, powerful voice. Will there ever be a Rebbe again, someone to assume the Chabad mantle of leadership? It's a very fascinating question. I don't have a black and white answer. Personally, I would love to see a Rebbe, because a movement needs centrality, needs focus. But Chabad is very unique. It's very different. You see an example of Boyan, how when the previous Boyana Rebbe died, there was no continuity. His two sons, and I happen to know the whole family, his two sons didn't want to be Rebbein. They were not cut out for it. They were business people. His daughter was married to Rebbe Menachem Breuer, my dear teacher. I write about him. Breuer. I write about him in Washington. He couldn't be a Rebbe, but one of his three children, an American-born and bred youngster, took upon himself to continue the tradition of his grandfather. That Boyana Rebbe today, going by the name Breyer, not Friedman, resuscitated Boyan. It's a viable Hasidus today. You can have resuscitation, but Lubavitch is very different. They had a tradition that there would only be seven Rebbeim. And that tradition speaks very loudly, continues very loudly. So you see, Chabad has turned into a movement, and it has added a concept that none of us have ever had before. Shluchim, reaching out, one more mitzvah. And that may be the key to their survival as a dominant part of the Torah people in the future. I have a lot more to say, but I leave it with a question mark. I can't be overly wise and tell you, Kizera e Vikadesh. Okay, I just want to say, No, I want to pick up with the messianicism. No, we didn't cover what I want to do. I want to deal with David Berger. And don't dismiss David Berger so quickly. Chabad has real problems. I also want to give you some. I want to deal with Chabad, the concept of Chabad. I want to deal with it, leave you with a little bit more depth on Chabad.
But you know, I find, if I may be allowed to say this,
yeah,
that your lectures on the Rebbe and Chabad show, exhibit, manifest tremendous amount of scholarship, study, effort, and the desire to portray a movement that has really made a solid contribution to Jewish life. And even though you're not a Chabadnik, and we're not Chabadnikim, but I think that you have a definitely communicated a respect and an admiration for the movement.
Listen, I benefit from the movement three different ways. Number one, whenever my son-in-law travels, Chabad gives him Shabbat and Kashrut. Number two, my Uncle Maxi put on tefillin twice in his life. Once at his bar mitzvah, and again at the kotel due to Chabad. And it could very well be that he's not in the category of a body that never put on tefillin. Number three, my wife's first cousin, once removed, totally knows nothing about Yiddishkeit, at university today in South Florida, is a Sinai scholar. That's part of the Raw Torah Leadership Institute. But I want to be honest, I have to deal with Berger. I have to quote David Berger to you. I have something to say very innovative on David Berger, how Chabad owes him a vote of thanks. You follow?
Do you also quote from Rabbi Shachet and Rabbi Rappaport?
Yeah, no, I'll show you. I'll show you what I have. I don't want to waste that. What Yitzchak is saying to me is, Rebbe, move on to Rabbi Hutner. That's what he's trying to say. I want to move on to Rabbi Hutner. I don't want to spend endless time, but I want to give you an outline and you can finish. Now, yesterday's shir, here's the picture you wanted. If anyone wants this picture, it played a role in yesterday's shir's, you will pick up. The Rav and the Rebbe. It's the picture from the famous Fabreng. Morty, this is what you wanted. If anyone wants a printout of what we were able to put together of Jay Solomon, gave it to me, and I made copies. It's the typescript of the Rav's talk when he dealt with Rabbi Rachman and Hafkat Kedushin. Okay, this is what we spoke about yesterday, David Berger, Chovevei Torah, anyone who wants. This is what we spoke about yesterday, Morty Tarikin, correcting me, but really not correcting me. If anyone wants the article, there it is. This is the article that everyone was talking about, Rabbanat Yotzeret. If you haven't seen it, it's kedai to read. This is Rabbi Harry Hefter, who taught in this kolo for about 15 years, taught Rabbi Bednash's shir. This is a fabulous article on someone I knew, Shmuel Reshevsky, the chess grandmaster, and his relationship with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. This is an article that's coming out in the next tradition, a portrait of two artists at the crossroads between Rav Kook and Shai Agnon. It's a beautiful piece of work by Jeffrey Sachs.
Really? Good.
This is a piece of work, something I alluded to in class when I quoted at the end of class, B'Yitziyatom, Mahu Omer, when you leave the Beis Medrash and you speak in terms of those who don't learn Torah going down to the pit of destruction. And I said off the cuff that it's a little bit too sharp. Believe it or not, as dear student Steve Jaffe sent me research done, do we really have to say that those who don't learn Torah go down to the pit of destruction? It's amazing how research is on everything. If anyone wants to read about the next president of Yeshiva University, Ari Berman, our own student from this kollel. Here is an unbelievable article that a fertility doctor would let people choose the sperm they wanted, AID, something we've spoken about in class, and he would use his own sperm instead and give it to them. They're now suing him. It's just beyond words. If anyone's interested in the history of Safa, I have two copies. This is request that Safa made for money from the Joint Distribution Committee. In other words, taking money from the Zionists. When I came to Maplewood, New Jersey in 1962, I had the shock of my life on Simchas Torah, Musaf, the Kohanim refused to duchen and told me this was the minhag in every Orthodox shul in Newark, New Jersey. Believe it or not, there's now an article coming out, a wonderful article by Rabbi Akiva Males in the next tradition on why Kohanim don't duchen on Simchas Torah because they're afraid that they will be drunk. If anyone wants the latest issue of Moment, which gives you an idea what the average mind is thinking about. My dear friends, with that I have given out all the freebies. Sunday's class, I'm giving a case study of a wonderful Orthodox rabbi who became conservative and what happens when you give in to passing whims and fancies. In this class, we're going to deal with David Berger, the critique, the messianicism, where do we go from there? And we're gearing and rolling to an end onto the Rebbe. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vidanya. There's the next class, next Sunday, Monday. The week after that, there is no class for obvious reasons. Erev Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Hashanah. Until we meet again in health and happiness, once again, Das Vidanya. Jay, good to see you.